Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a finely tuned compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this show, we take a deep breath and look long and hard at a box office giant. We step into the lights with a new exhibition at the Aspects Gallery, and we ask, what the folk are the Coen brothers up to now? Joining me as ever is the man who left that deal at the crossroads and hopped into pop instead, Dave Allen. Dave, welcome.
That's very good. Thank you, James. Nice to be here again.
We're going to start this show with cinema, with film. And this is, I suppose, I'm not going to use this term lightly, an epic film, I think. It's been described as a masterpiece, as a modern classic. And the film we're going to talk about is 12 Years a Slave, which you, I think, saw this morning.
I did. And I thought what I'd read about it and heard about it, that it was going to be such an immense experience that I put behind me the prejudice of about 5 years and actually went to the cinema, because I stopped going to the cinema about 5 years ago. I couldn't cope any longer with people texting, eating popcorn, talking behind me and so on and so on, and gave up, even though I'd once been a head of film studies at the university, gave up going to the cinema. But it just struck me that this was going to be such a massive thing. And I took myself off. I couldn't see it earlier in the week. Took myself off at 10:30 this morning, sat through it, and it was well worth it.
The experience itself, were you coaxed back into cinema watching?
Well, there was an oddness about it, I have to say, which I think is quite revealing. This is not about the film at all, but, you know, I think most people will know that, you know, in some senses, this is clearly a film with the depiction of some very harrowing experiences, not merely, you know, unspeakable physical mistreatment of other human beings, but psychological mistreatment and false imprisonment and rape and nastiness even within races and classes. So the white men were unspeakable to the white women, who were therefore unspeakable to the black women, and so on and so on. So everybody turns up knowing that. I did find it somewhat odd that the film was scheduled to start at 10:20, and at 10:20 what started were adverts and a game that you could play about the cinema with your mobile phone, and then previews of other movies, which were far less, far more trivial in a sense, and then more adverts and so on. We had 30 minutes of that while people poured in with trays with popcorn and, I don't know, fries at 10:30 in the morning, coffee and Coca-Cola. And I'm thinking, this is very odd, really. You know, so it did raise a question for me about what we think cinema is about, you know, because I'm absolutely about the idea that it's in the entertainment industry. But nobody could really have kidded themselves they were going to come and watch this film and be entertained as if they were on the Dodgem cars at a funfair. It wasn't that kind of entertainment. And there was a young woman who sat in front of me who, about halfway through, clearly got bored and went out and got another tray of popcorn and Coca-Cola, you know. So she missed, you know, one of the slaves being, you know, flayed within an inch of her life, you know, so that she could get another tray. And I'm just sitting there thinking, I can't take my eyes off this. I can't stop watching. So I don't know, really.
Whether it's kind of voyeurism or ignorance, we're not sure about that. But let's move to talk about the story, because the story is an interesting one itself. It's based upon a book, which is 12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup, who wrote the book, I think, around in 1853. And there were some rewrites, if you like, or not rewrites, but there was a supported version, if you like, that came out in the early 60s. But it's largely a forgotten book, but a very powerful story. Do you just want to kind of sketch out the story?
Oh, yeah, very powerful story. He is, Solomon is essentially a kind of middle-class black man in New York. So he's in the northern states, and a very accomplished fiddler, and lives a fairly luxurious lifestyle with wife and two children. And he is conned by two very plausible white middle-class gentlemen who tell him they're going to take him off to perform in a kind of circus, and he's going to earn a lot of money in a couple of weeks and come straight back. They get him drunk in a very opulent restaurant. They get him drunk one night. He wakes up the next morning in chains, and to cut a long story short, he's then transported down to Georgia and sold into slavery, you know. And apparently this was a fairly common experience, because I think by this time historically, I think you say the book was written in the 1850s. I think the narrative takes place in the 1830s, if I remember rightly. I think by this time slaves were not being transported, so there were two strategies. One was what happened to Solomon, which is that you're kidnapped and captured and sold into slavery, even though you are a free man. And they had, you know, they had papers to say they were free men. The other is that you encourage slaves on your plantation to procreate as much as you can. So there are always children coming through who are going to be the next generation of slaves. This happens to him, and he is told very quickly on the journey down, don't reveal that you can read or write. Don't tell anybody that you're a free man. Don't tell anybody about your family, because if you do any of those things, you will be killed. That will be it. It will be over. And so he has to live for 12 years as a slave until... We better keep the spoiler out. I mean, there is a crucial twist at the end to do with a benevolent white man. And that's a fascinating element of the story as well, because he has encounters with different kinds of white people, some of whom seem in some senses benevolent, but none of them at this point are sufficiently benevolent to take any kind of political position against it. You know, so even the first slave owner that he has, who's very kind to him, and his hand is forced in an issue with an overseer, even though he's very kind, he's still a slave master. You know, he still buys and sells slaves and the rest of that.
And there's a sense, I think, I mean, I haven't got to see the film yet, but there's a sense about the story itself that it focuses on one man's suffering and a particular kind of, you know, you mentioned it's kind of a middle-class free slave, but there's a madness to that, if you like, because there's a great context of tragedy occurring all around him. And you think that, you know, all right, this story is there and needs to be told. I wonder how much the film reflects the kind of wider despair of you know, particularly the kind of southern states. There's a great phrase, I had to look it up because it's a Latin phrase and I didn't do Latin at school, but the phrase antebellum, which means before the war. Okay, and that kind of describes this weird period where you've got very odd legal, political, social conditions really that apply to free slaves and slaves. And the tragedy of some of it is the injustices that were carried out against people in slavery. They had no right of redress or no right of appeal because they had no legal status, whether they were north, south or wherever.
They were property. And in fact, the particularly vindictive slave owner makes that point. He says, I can do what I like. These people are my property. And at one point likens them to the baboons that he's seen in, I think, in the New Orleans Zoo or something like that. But I think you ask a very pertinent question. It's a film made by a black British visual artist. You know, he is not a Hollywood film director. And he has made films. I mean, I can remember seeing work of his in an exhibition at the Hayward Gallery almost 20 years ago, which was very experimental, very avant-garde, more like a visual art filmmaker than even experimental cinema, if you like, filmmaker rather than cinema. What you see in this film, albeit, you know, this very harrowing, very revealing, you know, extraordinary film, you see a piece of what is essentially classic Hollywood cinema. There is a hero. There are other minor characters who are more or less heroic. There is a villain. You know, there is the bloke in the black cloak and the black hat, who, of course, is white, you know. But in that sense, it is classic Hollywood cinema. You know, there is there was a kind of mischievous thought, and I don't mean this seriously, but there was a mischievous thought that ran through my head at one point where I thought, this is like a thoroughly unsettling, unpleasant version of Downton Abbey. What this is a perfect recreation of a world of 180 years ago, but it is a costume drama, and it does have this hero who has to, you know, has to go through all this particular turmoil and purgatory, and, you know, one hopes at the end that there is going to be a happy ending, which, you know, in some senses there is, and as I say, I'm not going to give that away, but only in some senses. But it does beg an awful lot of questions, you know, and I think one of the really fascinating things about it, I certainly don't want to get into a big political debate here, but we are a week after a massive issue in North London around the relationship between black British community and Metropolitan Police a week ago. Mm. And yet the great liberal press of this country is saying, you know, Mark Kermode is saying, if you've got an interest in cinema, art, economics, politics, drama, literature, or history, you need to watch it. you know, not it would be a good idea, you've got to go, you know. You know, it does beg all those kinds of questions. What was that bigger context?
Mm.
Was the Civil War really about slavery, or was it about power relations and that was just tacked on? Once slavery was abolished, were people free? No, they certainly weren't. You know, we know that from the testimony of blues singers in the 1920s and 30s, a century on from Solomon. Mm. So there are so many things. I tell you what, what it does do in that sense is offer opportunities for groups, any groups who want to discuss those issues. It's a really wonderful place to start, because it is the other thing I would say about it is that it is a stunning piece of filmmaking. Whatever the subject matter might have been, you can really see that this is a man who's a visual artist, and he just beautifully put together.
Well, a lot's been made, I think, of the fact that Steve McQueen is a black British director. He would, I think, I read recently an interview with him, and he said, "I don't like being described as an artist. What I do is work." There's a lot been made about him being black and being British, and making a film of this scale about essentially white tragedy. Now, I think that says a lot about, you touched on it there with one of the reviews, it says a lot about some of the institutional feelings and prejudices of the press in, you know, not just in this country, but in the US as well. It's kind of, you know, we should judge this as a film, as a portrayal, as a representation of a story. A story that, I should add, has been thoroughly corroborated and has been, you know, researched to the point where they matched, I think, Sue Eakin in the late 60s, who helped produce the kind of modern version of the book, matched elements of environment, the descriptive narrative of the book, to actual places. And the key difference about the book, I think, is it names people. It names and shames. It doesn't do what other kind of similar kind of slave genre work, if you like, if that is a genre, does. It kind of skirts around it and vaguely points the finger. And you can understand why some of the other comparators do that. But this is a very to-the-point book. And I think the film, I think, does it do it justice? I mean, you obviously haven't read the book in detail, but that's a question. Does it do justice to the book and to the story? It does, in a sense that it illuminates slavery, I think, in a completely new way, but not perhaps completely new in the sense that it's reinterpreting it. Yes. It's saying, look, we've had cinema now, popular cinema, for 100, 150 years, whatever. We haven't told this story properly. No. We're going to do it now in full Technicolor and with some of the awkward pauses and some of the violence and the depravity and the kind of indignity left in.
It's interesting. I mean, there is always a characteristic about cinema, even if you take a very, you know, a relatively trivial example, like pop culture in the 1960s, which I'm very interested in. Nobody made a film about the mod culture, you know, and you'd have thought that would have been a real, you know, for 4 or 5 years, that would have been brilliant. But the first one that anybody made that was really, you know, a decent film about it was in 1979, Quadrophenia. So it takes time for cinema to adjust. But it does depend a bit what it is that it's adjusting to. So America, for example, I think large parts of America always had a kind of unspoken, in some cases, sense of shame about the Vietnam War. I think there are an awful lot of people there, particularly the liberal artistic left and so on, the people of Hollywood, who thought we shouldn't really be there, we shouldn't really be doing it. So during the Vietnam War, apart from the jingoistic Green Berets, they never made a film about it. They waited till it was over, and then you get Apocalypse Now saying, actually, this was mad. We were crazy. You know Robert Duvall's, you know, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Well, you look at something like Birth of a Nation, which is now 100 years old and was in some senses a remarkable piece of filmmaking, but in other senses a quite horrific depiction of injustice and unfairness and so on. Gone with the Wind, which trivialised the black experience, but it was in there. Glory, which was about a black unit during the war, you know, wearing the blue uniform, but actually, you know, apparently being ostracised and in the end sacrificing themselves, you know, for the cause. There have been these films and these depictions. Sidney Poitier daring to stand up to the policeman, Rod Steiger, in the heat of the night. You know, there have been these things, but not systematically. And as you're quite right, that there's not... We've always kind of known, haven't we, about the thing that we've always had a sense about what must have gone on in slavery. But this does show those things. And in some ways, oddly, while there is physical violence of a really unpleasant kind, and it's depicted fairly explicitly, some of the most distressing things come about where, for instance, the Fassbinder's character, the really nasty slave master, is as unpleasant to his wife, and his wife is deeply angry and upset about the fact that Fassbinder is having a sexual relationship with a black slave. It's only sexual, it's only about ownership and gratification. And so she is unspeakably cruel to this black slave and insists that the black slave eventually is whipped within an inch of her life and so on by you know, Solomon in the end has to do this. There is a point towards the end where you see the black slave is still she's abandoned, you know, she's left. You don't know what happens to her, you know, because Fassbinder's character is still there, the wife is still there. What's going to happen to this poor girl who's endlessly raped and you know, and is still probably only 25? And we don't know about that. So, you know, it does leave those kinds of questions hanging in the air.
Let's talk about some of the performances in the film, because yet again we come across Chiwetel Ejiofor, who we were familiar with. We kind of caught him, didn't we, in a BBC series, Stephen Polykoff. Can't remember what it was called, Dancing.
Yeah, it was. It was about the black jazz band in Britain in the 1920s, and I've completely forgotten.
Something like that. Yeah, there was dancing in the title. Yeah, anyway, he was fantastic in that, and certainly most of the things I've seen him in, he's been very, very good. He's one of those, for me, he's one of those actors who has presence and will go on to greater, higher things. He's in the Christian Bale league, if you like, in my estimation.
I didn't think there was a single bad performance in it, frankly.
Mm.
I don't know how much the director gets credit for that. I mean, I don't think he does in the case of, you know, the lead character, but every aspect of that for me was stunning, really. He was brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant. Because even though he was taking that advice, acting that role where it was keep quiet, keep your head down, so there were moments where he was provoked, you know, into resistance. And you thought, God, how far is he going to go here? And, you know, It was fascinating the way he was playing that tension between himself and the people in power over him. You could tell that they could tell he was, you know, to suspend disbelief for a moment, that they could tell within the film that he was a bright black man. There was something about it. And that they didn't know why, because they didn't know his history.
Mm.
But there was something there that made them a bit wary. It was, the acting was brilliant.
And there's certainly from the clips that I've seen, there's a real kind of, maybe a toxic one, but there's a real kind of chemistry between Chiwetel Ejiofor and Michael Fassbender in terms of, you know, they're the kind of key protagonists, aren't they? They're kind of, they're the lead roles, if you like. They work very closely, very well together, albeit they're, you know, they're completely opposed to each other, if you like, in the piece, but there's something to that, and that's for me, that's an indication of great acting. You know, they get into, it's not method acting, but they get into a mode. Yeah. They connect in a way that, you know, other actors can't get near.
Fassbinder is a completely non-reflexive, powerful figure. He's the power lord, but he's completely non-reflexive. He has no mirror. He has no sense of how he's behaving. He knows everything to be right. I mean, one of the most alarming things is the way these white landowning slave owners would gather together their slaves and other, you know, menial people and read the Bible to them. Just extraordinary kind of contradiction there is in that, really. You know, these passages from the Bible that, and then they're all after saying amen at the end, you know, to some kind of profound spiritual idea, and then it's right, get back in that field. And, you know, there's a hypocrisy that is so ingrained in those people that they have no sense of it whatsoever. They believe that this is the right way to behave. They believe in the words that they're reading.
And that, I guess, is an element about it reflecting the wider context, isn't it? You know, that in it, it's not the focus of the tragedy, but that is a tragedy. You know, this is a failure of humanity. There is a wider tragedy. Everyone involved in this comes out of it with blood on their hands, effectively.
It is in modern history one of the great failures of humanity, which I think that's a very apt phrase. You know, it is the Holocaust in a different century, in a different continent, but it is. And there's no question that you said about America, and you're quite right. But there's no question that Britain was complicit in it.
Well, leave your copies of the Sunday Times at home and your popcorn, and go with an open mind. 12 Years a Slave, Certificate 15, is out now. We move now to art. And earlier on this month, I went along to the preview of the Creating Balance project, which is a collaborative project between Anglepoise, Strong Island, and the University of Portsmouth. And I was fortunate enough to catch up with some of the artists and the organisers alike, and was started by having a chat with Strong Island. So I'm joined by Paul Ganella of Strong Island. Paul, what's been your involvement in Creating Balance?
We've been running for about 5 years, Strong Island, and over the last 3 years we've run an exhibition each year. They tend to be pulling together different artists and photographers from around the city. It's about promoting local creativity. And Claire Sandbrook, who we've worked with on a few occasions, she's based at university, had a great idea about working with Angle Poise, who are based just off the island. And we sort of found a way of pulling together two different groups of people, 10 photographers and 10 artists or designers, and using the lamp as a sort of crucible for them to kind of be creative. And it started off in one way, and it just developed and developed over time, and it's resulted in an exhibition that was shown in London during London Design Week and also in Winchester just before Christmas, and now at Aspects tonight with the opening night in Portsmouth, which we're really pleased about, coming home and showing all the work to all the friends and family.
So how difficult was it to start with a lamp? So you paired up a photographer and an artist and you said, here's an Angle Poise lamp. Do what you will. How difficult was that, do you think, as a challenge?
To be honest, I felt sorry for the people at the start of the project because they kind of had that question of what do we really do? We were quite open with the scope of the project and allowed people to kind of do what they liked. And I think what happened was, as the project progressed, all of a sudden people started to want to customise their lamp and do different things with it. And the partnerships that happened before, the collaborations that happened before, looked at what was going on and then developed their ideas in different directions. And it's kind of really grown organically over the year that the project's run. And I think the exhibition here in Portsmouth is different to the London exhibition because we now have more work that's continued to be created after the sort of official end of the project, as it were. So there's more photography, more customised lamps, and these collaborations that started off sort of by people being put together who may not have known each other, they're now working together independently, they're working with other businesses, and these connections really between totally different artists, designers and photographers who didn't know each other have spawned new ideas, new work, and also actual sort of paid work as well. Some of these people are now able to get commissions and work from other businesses, so it's sort of spawned the work in the exhibition but lots and lots of other work and ideas in parallel.
So what have been from the whole project today, what have been some of your favourite elements? What things have you seen that you thought, wow, I didn't think that was possible with a piece of lighting?
For me, my favourite was just being, I've just been surprised almost all the way through the project. I think we knew that people were going to customise some lamps, but it's quite an iconic silhouette, as it were, an Angle Poise lamp. And I wasn't sure how people would to sort of develop it or change it. And it seems to be, for many people, it's not so much how it looked, but how it was used. So My Dog Size, a local street artist, has used it as his palette. And over time, the paint being placed on it and then used to create his artwork has built up and built up. And it looks like, you know, any painter's palette. But it tells a story of all the work that he's produced in 2013. He's had a few very large exhibitions, and all of that work produced can sort of in some way be traced back to that lamp. So it has lots of sort of stories about it. And I think many of the lamps that have been created have a story to tell rather than just being painted or illustrated. They've been done for a particular reason with a particular idea behind it.
And there have been some fairly unconventional things done with lamps, I think, in terms of whatever convention is, of course. They've been dipped in the sea and they've been left on the motorway and they've been attacked by blacksmiths and all kinds of different things.
Yeah, I worked with my business partner Tristan, who also works at Strong Island, and Tristan had the idea of placing it in the Solent and seeing what would happen. We've had a couple of ideas about doing similar things but never really done it and had no idea how it would work. And Claire had a connection with David Jones at Triton Scuba in Southsea, who's an underwater photographer and filmmaker and also a diving instructor, and they were fantastic, and they explained that you couldn't just hop in the water and attach it to a piece of metal or concrete. You had to have a proper three-man diving team, and all of a sudden we were sort of in awe about whether we could do it. And they were so helpful and spent so much time to guide us through what needed to be done. And the lamp went into Southsea Marina, who were very supportive too, and it was there for 3 months, and we had no idea what was going to happen if nothing, if it might be exactly the same as when it went in. It turned out that it was covered in life. It had been sort of absorbed by the ecosystem under the water, and it was below the low tide line, so it had all sorts of creatures living in it and amongst it. So
there's a great picture of it covered in kind of weed and barnacle.
That was the photograph I took, and I'd shot that. We took the lamp out, Tristan reassembled it, and we then placed it in the Solan, and I shot it in the water. And as well as the photograph of the lamp back in the sea once again, we also have photographs of the diver next to it in full scuba gear, and it was meant to sort of represent his working lamp on his desk, at the sea as his desk, as it were. And that was his use of the lamp. So that's,
I'm guessing that he might have invalidated the warranty with that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've got a funny feeling we're not going to be able to take that one back.
No,
but
no.
Thankfully, Anglepoise donated all the lamps to the project and were very kind, and I think their supporters would has made this project possible.
Well, I shall let you get back to the bustle, and importantly to the tea beer that I think has been specially brewed.
The lovely people at Brew House and Kitchen, and also All About Tea, both Portsmouth companies.
It looks like a hearty brew, so while you enjoy some of that, Paul, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Simon, let's come to you. Simon Terry from Anglepoise. Anglepoise is one of the definitive British classic design names, isn't it? It's the kind of, I think it's the Ferrari of the office. I think you might call it that. You know,
that's an unusual one. I've never heard that before.
But it's there's some dangers, I think, in terms of taking something iconic like an Anglepoise lamp and throwing it into a kind of open context. How did you? You said that Claire said that you met here at the gallery. How did you kind of come to this project? What have you looked
well?
To
I think
get
it was. It was an interesting start because Claire sort of turned up on the doorstep one day at Anglepoise with this sort of idea, and I sort of thought, here we go. It was all flung together, but actually she's spent years understanding these artists and photographers, and she kind of knows who are firstly the talented people and also who is going to work well together. And that's a very specific skill, and it's something that's very difficult to do. And that has proven itself in the work, because the quality of work has come out of collaborations that have worked. If they hadn't worked, the quality of work being very poor, and that would have probably reflected badly, but it hasn't. I think it's really shown that this part of the world, down in Portsmouth, we can produce work that is as good as anywhere else in the world or up in London. I mean, for me personally, before I met Claire, pretty much all of my sort of graphic work, photography, was all London-based. And I didn't really think there was all this talent on the doorstep, but what it's shown me is actually there is enormous talent here that should be nurtured and celebrated. And other brands like ourselves should get more involved and work with local talent. It's very important.
Was there something in the project for you as a company that was about maybe sort of demonstrating how your product had moved on, if you like, in terms of demonstrating how modern the product is? Because many people, I think, you look at an Anglepoise lamp, the shape and the form of it is fairly as was in the 1930s whenever it appeared, but you know there are things that have changed in terms of lighting. I mean, you know, it's something we take for granted every day, but you know there's kind of energy efficiencies, different materials, all those kind of things. So is there something in sort of entering into this project maybe that you thought we can demonstrate that it's not perhaps an old school product?
In some ways, but I think the interesting thing for us has always been, you know, stories about energy efficiency and all that stuff, and we were discussing energy efficiency back in the 1930s. When I look back in our archive a couple of years ago, we literally, our vans had printed on the side, the Anglepoise lamp saved 25% electricity. So everyone's banging on about it now. Actually, it's been going on for years. But I think for me, the exciting thing is more from a brand point of view, to say, you know, how can you refresh a brand or look at a brand in a different way and allow people to interface with your brand? So it's almost about creating a two-way conversation with a brand. I think that's very important. And I've learned an enormous lot by allowing artists and photographers to look at our products in different ways. It's very exciting. I get a real buzz. Sort of next day, I suddenly see a picture turning up of something, and it's a real sort of thrill. It's a real excitement.
Did you have some nervous moments where you thought, oh no, look what they've done to my beautiful lamps?
There are nervous moments, and especially it's like tonight, some things have turned up today I haven't actually seen before. So it's a little bit of nervousness. But then it's actually knowing, because those guys have been carefully selected, that actually they know what they're doing. It's their reputation as well.
Each artist or photographer could choose whatever lamp they actually wanted, apart from the giants. And these were just dished out to them, and then we involved university students to do the filming. So each collaboration was actually filmed. So again, we could use all of this amazing material for social media and to drip feed that content. So there was quite a lot of hype before the initial launch in London, just to kind of get that message out there and to sell the city out of the city.
Let's come to Jack Daly, who's sitting here soaking this all in. You had the task, I suppose, as an artist, of kind of trying to approach this from what kind of angle? How did you, when you approached the project, what were your initial thoughts? What do you think? What can I do with a lamp?
It was, well, I was paired with an artist and I'm a photographer. So initially, it was a bit of a shock for Claire to tell me that, because normally when you work with a big iconic brand, they don't give you as much freedom as Angle Poise and Simon has given the project. So to be able to rein off any ideas that me and my dog had and to sort of go anywhere with it was a bit of a refreshment when dealing with a brand.
And we should say that my dog is the artist, is that right? My dog size
is his name.
We should explain that for the listeners.
Although he doesn't have a dog, he has a cat, I've been told. Okay. I've only recently learned, actually.
So how did the creative process start in terms of, you know, you had an idea that, you know, there was a kind of, I don't want to say blank canvas, but there weren't very many kind of limitations put on you in the start. Where did you start from with the kind of...
Dog, the artist, started with his lamp deciding how he was going to sort of paint it in a way. Mm. And he used his as a palette, so his is the one that's all multicoloured. So he started doing that before I came up with any ideas, and from then all the ideas sort of led from his lamp. So we decided to shoot his lamp with the figures and the cans that he's iconic and known for, and that was where the idea came from. And we shot it similar to how I've shot other stuff I've done with him before and what I was known for before that as well.
Now, a lot of people coming to this might think, well, this is definitely, it's going to be about light and it's going to be about illumination, but it's not, there's some of that, but it's really about mechanics and balance, and
it's about
equilibrium's a good word, isn't it? Is it?
Equilibrium's a great word, yeah. It's more about the balance between both the artist and the photographer and the ideas that they have, as well as the balance with Angle Poise and the University of Portsmouth.
Claire, if I come back to you, it occurred to me when I was kind of doing my homework for this that there's something about a great British brand being updated in terms of, you know, reflecting how Britain's changed since the lamp appeared, if you like. And I think the lamp appeared kind of probably towards the end of the 19th century, is that?
1930s, yeah.
1930s, okay. Yeah. So, was it consciously about that kind of national identity as well? Was there an element of that, or...?
I think, yes, I mean, you know, there's been a complete resurgence in British manufacturing and in the States as well. You know, they're going through this, you know, the whole thing about US made and, you know, celebrating that.
Yeah.
So, and I know with Angle Poise, the giant lamp is actually, is it 100% made in the UK?
That is a giant Angle Poise lamp, which is kind of like you've been thrown into Lilliput, isn't it? Or kind of, or whatever the reverse is of that.
Yeah.
It's done a bit of a tour, hasn't it? It's appeared in some places, but it may be appearing in others. Is that right, mate? Or?
Well, the giants started life because basically Roald Dahl literally had an Angle Poise in his writing den in Great Missenden, and we were approached about 5 years ago by Lissy Dahl, his wife, to basically make a giant lamp for the museum and story centre they were building. So that's where the whole thing started. So we made that and showed it, and then everyone sort of fell in love with it and wanted to buy it. So it was a sort of happy accident, I suppose, in many ways. And since then, it's just gone from strength to strength with the product, and we sell them all over the world, and lots of, you know, quite famous people have them and sort of buy them. But yeah, it's certainly a conversation piece.
Yeah, and the actual lamp has been used by one of the photographers who's taken it around the city. What happened after the London launch, we decided that, you know, when it came to Portsmouth, we wanted to do this sort of little teasers of work, and We've had photographer Russell Squires, who's used one of the lamps to take some special portraits of people around the city, and he's going to be continuing that as well throughout the exhibition. And the same with photographer Andrew White. He's been using the giant lamp around the city at iconic landmarks, and again, they're going to be kind of drip-fed throughout the exhibition.
Not something you can kind of sneak in, is it, really, the giant lamp?
He's managed to do a really good job of getting away with it. I mean, on the M275 and...
Not in bright yellow, no. It sort of does tend to stand out, but he's pretty nifty with it.
Simon, Claire, Jack, thanks very much for your time. I'll let you back to the preview. I can hear the crowds bashing the door down already. Thanks very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen. And we're reflecting now, I think, Dave, on the Creating Balance project. You heard there a couple of snippets, interviews with some of the protagonists, with Strong Island and the university. Some of your partners in crime, as it were, are involved in this one. This is it's a curious one, isn't it? It's a very creative project. It's essentially taking something familiar to all of us, the Anglepoise lamp. And as I said in the interview there, it's very familiar to DJs and broadcasters because it looks very much like a kind of radio mic arm. taking them, pairing them up with 10 photographers, 10 artists, and coming up with all kinds of fascinating and sort of quite off-the-wall things, really. What did you take from this?
Well, you're right about partners in crime, particularly Claire Sandbrook, who was the kind of guiding light from the university's side, who's an old pal of mine. And, I didn't know a whole lot about the project until, like you, I went to the opening night at the Aspects Gallery. It did my heart a great deal of good. Because I've been associated in various ways with the Aspects Gallery since it opened 30 odd years ago. It used to be down in Brown Road, and it's now near Gunwolf. And there have been some glorious nights and some wonderful events there. And sometimes you turn up to an opening and there's five people, and you think, oh, this is a bit sad. And you drink lots of glasses of wine because nobody else does.
And two of them are us.
Yes. And last Friday was amazing. It's just like half of Portsmouth had turned up. It was quite incredible, and it did my heart good. It made me feel very proud to be part of Portsmouth and to recognise that there is this creative community in Portsmouth that will come out and celebrate and support all that kind of thing. Now, the only problem on Friday night, there was only one problem with it, was I couldn't get near any of the art. I didn't have a clue what the exhibition or the work was about at all, because there were just so many people there. So all I did was chat to people and go round the other exhibition at the other end of Aspects and go away. So what I did do was take the pack of postcards, which are quite delightful in themselves, took them away, and I took the little brochure thing away, and I read that, and then I popped back the day after I'd been to the movies and had another look round, which was much easier because there was nobody there. So I got a much stronger sense of what had been done. There were 10 artists, designers, architects, and 10 photographers. And they collaborated, didn't they? So how much they collaborated, quite how much, I'm not entirely clear, but it seemed to me that by and large the artists made work and the photographers took the photographs of them making the work or took photographs of the work. And it may have been a closer collaboration than that, in which case I apologise. But I like that. I think the title intrigued me. I'm a Libran, you see, so I spend my entire life creating balance. Now, one of the myths, we won't talk too much astrology here, but
this could be a whole new genre for you, Dave.
It could be. Actually, I could do an astrological reading every month. But one of the things people say about Librans, you see, is that they're well balanced. They're the only one of the 12 zodiac signs that's represented by an inanimate object, which is a pair of scales, right?
I see.
Now, the interesting thing for me about there are two things here. First of all, Librans are not well balanced. They are people who like to be well balanced. So the thing is, if you throw them out of balance, they're just in chaos, which happens quite a lot. So they're not.
They need their chakra realigning, do they?
Yes. I mean, well balanced, Margaret Thatcher, Jeff Boycott, John Lennon. I don't think so.
There's a list.
Yes. So, but the thing about, if you think about the classic image of the scales, what you have on scales, generally speaking, is two entirely disparate things which hold each other in a balance through some kind of tension. So on one side you've got a weight, and on the other side you've got flour, for example. And you need 2 pounds of flour to do something or whatever it is, So they're not the same things at all. I would be intrigued to sit with these people and say, tell me about you know, balance as opposed to tension. I mean, maybe this would be a less poppy thing. What about a dialectical relationship, which is not necessarily balance? It's much more about flow in and out and so on and so on. So the title is one thing that intrigues me. But I do want to say, I do want to make the point that, first of all, I thought Friday night was a great celebratory event, and that there are some, at the very least, there are some really fun objects and fun images. And maybe it's a little presumptuous of me to start pushing it beyond that and saying, well, I want this to be really, you know, I want this to be dialectical, and then it could become political, and perhaps, you know, nobody's actually looking for that, you know, because I've got a array of the images in front of me now, you know, and there's somebody sat in a garden with you know, what looks like a, you know, a tin pail, tin bucket on his head, which is, you know, the same shape as the anglepoise, the main bit of the lamp, you know.
Yeah.
And somebody else, a couple of people who made interesting collages. But what about you? Come on, tell me what you made of it.
I mean, I really enjoyed this. I mean, I came to this not really knowing a lot about it. I just, you know, it's a project that's been going on, I think, for the last sort of 9-10 months or so. And the kind of the exhibition preview, the launch, if you like, was a kind of, I suppose, the kind of culmination of that work. There are a number of things I mentioned in the interviews. There are a number of things that kind of hit me about it in terms of sort of identity and about, you know, the kind of the company itself trying to explore the modernity of its product, if you like, through something creative. But the more and more I think about it, you know, the title is an intriguing one, and it's more, I think, about a balance between kind of the mechanical and the natural. Okay, and what I mean by that is that, you know, and we've alluded to this already, there are anglepoise lamps look like limbs. They look like menacing creatures. They look like something that kind of, you know, will hop across a table and scare you. But they are, I've got one on my desk at work, they are practical things that keep us working, if you like. They, you know, illuminate the desk, so they allow me to stay awake at work. It's not particularly natural. It's a natural kind of, it doesn't provide natural light, is what I'm saying. It keeps me a slave to the machine, if you like. And there's a balance in it throughout this project, I think. There's a balance of most of the things that the artists have tried to do is they've sort of said, well, not just what the product means in our day-to-day life, but how does it influence our day-to-day life? And also, it influences us much more than just a lamp that lights up a desk. But yes. I mean, I enjoyed it. I mean, it, as we always say on this program, kind of, if art makes you think and is a bit challenging, that's good, isn't it? Kind of, even if it makes you angry and cross, you know, that's good in itself. It kind of encourages emotion. I think there are some wacky things wound up in this project. I'm not going to name names, but there are also some amazing bits of photography. You've got just in front of you a black and white image there, which is kind of makes a sphere of different anglepoise.
It's like a almost like a kaleidoscope.
It is, but it reminds me very much of something from 2001 AD, A Space Odyssey. Yeah. You know, it's kind of, it's HAL all over again. And I think there are elements of creating the uncontrollable.
Okay, there's one thing that I want
to... Is this the free beer?
This is. Oh, no, I didn't have
it. Oh, okay.
I'm off alcohol at the minute, so I didn't. But the beer was beer and tea beer, wasn't it?
It was.
I got two images that particularly intrigued me in terms of... this is almost like throwing a question out, and I don't know whether the people involved will be listening to this and whether they'll have a view of it, but I'm going to try. The first is an old mate of mine was one of the people involved in this, a guy called Pete Clutterbuck, who's Portsmouth's blacksmith, and he's a wonderful man. He also happens to love cricket. Now, anybody who loves cricket's all right by me, but I've known Pete Clutterbuck for 40 odd years, you know, from his days as an art student. He's great, and he collaborated with the photographer Andrew White, and they produced this fabulous picture of South Sea Bandstand with all sorts of sparks coming off the anglepoise lamp in front of it, which is, you know, there's a kind of deep focus photograph there, and it's a wonderful thing. But it's the bandstand that interests me, because the bandstand is a site for music. Now, one of the things about the Creating Balance project is it involved a lot of the people who, a year or two ago, including my pal Claire, they produced a book called Creative Portsmouth. And I thought, oh, that's exciting. I'll have a look in there and see what it says about music. And I did, and it didn't. And I thought, so those of us that are, I mean, you know, I've been an art teacher, art lecturer all my life, still make visual images, made in some today. But I've also been a musician all my adult life. And I thought, Creative Portsmouth, and there's no music in it. So here's an image of Pete Clutterbuck's, okay? Now, anglepoise lamp. Think about the end of an anglepoise lamp. It looks to me like the bell of a trumpet. If you took two of them, they could be headphones. It's like a megaphone. It's like the mute that you use on the end of a trumpet, Miles Davis. And I'm kind of intrigued that they got all these creative people together and nobody, as far as I can tell, made any sounds. And I walk round the show today on my own. I don't know whether I should tell anybody this, really, because the artists might all sue me now, but I walked around it banging the work. And there was a big one, and there were smaller ones, and there were ones caked in things, and they all sounded different. And I thought, you could make really nice orchestral pieces with this. I mean, experimental, but okay, you could. And nobody did it. And I asked somebody in the Aspects Gallery, I said, was there no sound here? Because what they were doing for the exhibition was they were using the sound system in the Aspects Gallery and playing some kind of, you know, ambient trance dance music just put on at random. It had nothing to do with the exhibition. And I'm like, why isn't there sound to go with this exhibition made from these things? If you bang, you know, the stems of Anglepoise lamps with bits of metal, they'd make great sounds. You bang the springs, they'd make, you know, you if you whip down the spring, it would sound like a washboard. You could have done all kinds. And so this is not a criticism of anything that is there. It's genuinely a question. I'm just wondering why all those creative people never thought.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, one of the things I tried to explore was, you know, this, and it came out quite clearly that this isn't an exhibition about light or about illumination, which you would think is an obvious thing for a lamp.
Yeah.
Okay. They were very clear it's about, you know, the physicality of the object, you know, the kind of the mechanical, you know, the springs and the widgets and all those kind of things. So maybe, you know, it's kind of the focus wasn't on senses in, you know, well, do you think that way.
Do you think they'd have stopped them if somebody had said, because if they'd invited me to do it, as, you know, as somebody who was an artist and has been involved in the visual arts community in Portsmouth all my life, if they said, well, you come and do one, Dave. And I'd have started doing a musical one. Do you think they said no? They wouldn't have said no.
I don't think anyone would turn you away lightly, Dave. But no. I think, I mean, there is something in this as well. It's, you know, it's very clear that the project is designed to be a platform for other things. You know, it's a kind of, I suppose, in some ways, it's a starting point. It's trying to say, look, there are artists and photographers and creativity in Portsmouth. The stereotypes about Portsmouth aren't true. There's a lot of creativity. There's a lot of art.
Sure.
There's all kinds of different things. This is a kind of, you know, this is a quirky project around lamps, but actually it's brought together a whole load of kind of people, it's networked to a whole load of people that might spark off in different directions. One of those could be, you know, the Dave Allen Anglepoise Orchestra, but for example.
I have two bigger points to make about this, which is that there is a sense for me in which the Academy and the current impetus on training people and getting people jobs and all that kind of stuff, which now impinges on the art world in a way that it didn't when I was a young student, all of that has begun to compartmentalise creativity. So there is a considerable amount of innovative and creative music that goes on in the university, you know, and this was partly a university project, but it's about visual art. Now, the interesting thing is, if you go back a century and you look at the early modernist initiatives of the futurists, the constructivists, of Dada, of the Bauhaus, and so on and so on, all of those people were working in the performing arts, they were working in architecture, they were working in design, they were working in visual arts, they were working in sound. All those things were coming together. And actually, that occurred again, most interestingly, in Portsmouth Art College in the early 70s. When there were those initiatives for people like Cornelius Cardew and Michael Nyman and, you know, people associated with Pink Floyd and Brian Eno, Portsmouth Symphonia. And within fine art in Portsmouth, there was a lot of musical experimental work. And it seems to me that spirit of collaboration across the disciplines and across the media is less strong now than it used to be. And maybe it's just a particular interest and hobby horse of mine. And I do want to stress once again that this is not in any sense a criticism of what was there, because what was there was great and the event was great and well done to them. I'm just asking a question about creativity in Portsmouth, about why it is that there seems to be this separation between different kinds of practices in a way that hasn't always been. That is not about not going to the exhibition. It's not about not enjoying it. It's brilliant. Well done, Portsmouth. Well done, Strong Island. Well done, Claire Sandbrook in particular, who I love dearly. Well, you know, the university and Anglepoise and all of that. Great. But, you know, phase two, invite me in with my mad musical friends and, you know, see what could happen.
It's an open invitation. We'll put some of the images and some of the links that are out there on the internet on our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.com, and you can go and see the exhibition at the Aspects Gallery in Gunwharf Quays until the 2nd of March. More details at www.aspects.org.uk, and you can give them a buzz on the old telephone if you fancy on 023 92 77 8080. Just before we go, we're going to have a quick word about folk. Yes, I said folk, so don't start writing in now. There's a new film, I think, Dave, coming out by the Coen brothers, which is called Inside Llewyn Davis. Okay, so tell us a bit about that.
Well, it's based loosely, as I understand it, around the story of a man called Dave Van Ronk, who I suppose these days is best remembered for the man who made the arrangement of the famous song House of the Rising Sun. Now, he didn't write it, you know, it has its origins deep back. I mean, certainly Josh White performed it, and it was, you know, unaccompanied in the 30s. But he made this arrangement of that song, which Bob Dylan took without really telling him and put on his first album, and it was Bob Dylan was on his way. Dave Van Ronk he wasn't as young, he was a bit more dour, he was bearded, but he was part of that extraordinary folk scene in New York around Greenwich Village in the early 60s, and he was the kind of leading light. And Dylan was the young, apparently naive kid who really clearly knew where he was going, who took off and became the superstar, and Van Ronk and others didn't. And there's been lots of stories written about him and about Dylan and about other people, and Susie Rotolo, who's Dylan's girlfriend, has written stories about it, and Van Ronk's story came out. Van Ronk is no longer alive, but there are recordings of him and so on. And the Coen brothers have taken these stories and they've constructed around it a fictional account of this guy called Llewyn Davis, who's a bit more of a loser than Dave Van Ronk, as far as I can tell from what I've read of the film so far. And I will be keen to see it because the Coen brothers make remarkable films. I mean, they've been to music before with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, for instance, and they work with T-Bone Burnett, who's very knowledgeable about all that root stuff. And I think that what they will do is construct a very plausible version of that world. Now, the big question, I suppose, is the extent to which people are going to be fascinated by that world. Now, I am, because I'm a man of that generation and that musical genre and so on. But, you know, that doesn't mean that it's going to get a mass audience. And I don't know the truth about that. But I'm personally looking forward to it.
So we're going to try and explore folk more in the next programme. Yeah. The film itself is based on a book, I think, The Mayor of MacDougall Street,
which is Van Ronk's story, yeah.
So seek that out before the next show. There's your homework. And also, go onto YouTube, it's very popular, and listen to Dave Van Ronk's version of House of the Rising Sun. I would say it's a kind of very cracked, very doomed version of the song. It's a gloomy song anyway. Yeah. But listen to it, sir. It's an interesting one. We should, just before we wrap up the programme, mention a couple of events that are coming up that you should get out and see. We've already talked about 12 Years a Slave. It's out now in the cinema. I'm going to try and get to see it, and we suggest that you do as well. And also, Creating Balance, as we mentioned, is there at the Aspects Gallery until the 2nd of March.
The thing I would like to mention is the exhibition at the Guildhall that I'm involved in called Access All Areas, which has a permanent show about the history of popular music in Portsmouth since the war. There is currently... what they also have are travelling exhibitions that come from places like Victoria and Albert. So they've currently got My Generation, The Glory Years of British Rock, which is actually backstage at at Top of the Pops, and very good show it is. But that's finishing on the 1st of February, and then almost to coincide really with the Inside Llewyn Davis, on the 5th of February, for the whole of February and March, there are photographs of Bob Dylan by a guy called Barry Feinstein, and Dylan touring in Britain in the 60s, for instance. It's on the first floor of Portsmouth Guildhall. It's open Monday to Friday 9 to 5:30, Saturday 10 to 4, and you can find out all about it from the Guildhall box office or at reception in the Guildhall.
Excellent. Now, if you're lost for something to do, something a bit different, if you like, on Valentine's Day, February 14th, you can go along to the Cellars at Eastney and see Miles Hunt of Wonderstuff fame and Erica Knuckles perform at 7:30. Check the website, thecellars.co.uk.
Will that be full of love?
I'm sure it'll be full of all kinds of big love, Dave.
I've got one more, and I have mentioned this before, but it's a wonderful and not particularly well-known artist, Claire Leighton. It's called Working Life. It's at the Pallant Gallery until the 24th of February, an exhibition of woodcuts, mostly working life in America, and in some ways has a slightly tangential relationship to 12 Years a Slave. There's quite a lot of images of I mean, it's post-slavery, but of people working working in the south and so on, and a brilliant show it is.
And if you fancy something a little more spiritual, if you like, on the 18th of February at the King's Theatre, you can catch the Reduced Shakespeare Company and their version of The Bible, The Complete Word of God. You can find out more information on their box office at 023 9282 8282. That's it for this edition of Towards the Point. We'll be back again at our regular slot the last Monday in every month. Thanks to Dave Allen.
Thank you.
Check out our blog, towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.